want to share something with you this morning. I've been waiting this entire series to share, and it's something that brings me joy, and I hope it brings you joy too. Watch this. Oh my goodness. If that doesn't bring a joy to your heart, I don't know what will. Well, we've been going through this series called Rebellious Joy. And we've been looking at this incredible little book of the Bible called Philippians, and it's a letter that Paul wrote to the church there. And what we have definitely learned as we've gone through this series is that rebellious joy is not wrapped up in the external circumstances of our life. No, rebellious joy comes from the inside out. It comes from a very, very deep place down inside of us. And so today, here's what I want to do. Before we move ahead and look at chapter 4, I want to just hit rewind here for a moment. And so if you have your Bibles, let's go ahead and grab them and open them to Philippians. And what I want to do is just go back and remind us the journey that Paul has taken us all on. And you might remember as we began the very first week that Paul said these words. He said this in chapter 1, verse 6. "And I am certain that God, who began the good work within you, will continue his work until it is finally finished on the day when Christ Jesus returns." You see, what Paul is saying here right off the bat is that joy is not something that you can manufacture. Joy is not something that you can fake. It's not something you can just paint on the outside of your face. It's not something that's just surface level. No, joy comes from deep within. It comes from a creator getting deep into our hearts and changing us from the inside out. And then we saw in chapter 2 that this thing called rebellious joy and humility go hand in hand. Those two things go together, and it's countercultural to think that the way to up is actually down, that we descend into greatness. And then what we did is we read what I believe is like the golden rule for relationships. And here's what Paul said in Philippians 2, verse 3. "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves." And then Paul went on to say, "Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant." He descended into greatness, and so God elevated him to the highest place possible because of his humility. And so in chapter 3, then we also found out that joy cannot be found in religion or religious ritual or a bunch of rules. Even though many studies today would show that people who attend church are happier than people who don't. But still, just attending a religious event does not bring that deep-seated joy that we're looking for. And so what Paul said, "I was there. I did all that. But you know what that was to me? Garbage." I mean, that's what he says, and look what he wrote. "I've dumped it all in the trash so that I could embrace Christ and be embraced by him. I didn't want some petty, inferior brand of righteousness that comes from keeping a list of rules when I could get the robust kind that comes from trusting Christ, God's righteousness. I gave up all that inferior stuff so I could know Christ personally, experience his resurrection power, be a partner in his suffering, and go all the way with him to death itself." I mean, what Paul was saying here is I don't want to fake it. mean, I want real life. I want to know Jesus. I want to experience this real, deep, inside-out kind of joy that comes from an authentic relationship with God. Now, last weekend, you might remember I brought a running shoe up here on stage. We talked about training for a marathon and how if you're training for a marathon, it is absolutely going to dominate your entire life. It's going to affect the way you eat. It's going to affect the way you sleep. It's going to affect the way you train. And Paul is saying, man, in my relationship with Christ, I mean, this is what I want. And so let's just read this verse out loud together. And this was kind of Paul's charge to us about that end. And so let's just throw those words up here on the screen and read this out loud together. Forgetting the past and looking forward to what lies ahead, I press on to reach the end of the race and receive the heavenly prize for which God, through Christ Jesus, is calling us. Now, I don't know about you, but I want the kind of joy that goes the distance. I mean, that's the goal, and if that is the goal for my life, then here's the deal. Along the way, I'm going to have to learn a whole lot about what we are talking about today. And what we are going to talk about today is rebellious contentment. Rebellious contentment. Now, I don't know if you've ever taken one of those personality profile tests. You know what I'm talking about? One of those tests where you have to answer all these yes and no questions or rank yourself 1 through 5, and they tell you whether or not you're extroverted or introverted, whether you're a thinker or a feeler. Well, I took one of these tests, but this test had kind of a very interesting twist to it. It was like a spiritual disciplines test that went along with this personality profile. And what it was supposed to do is kind of align me where I'm at in my spiritual walk and tell me what kind of maybe barriers are in front of me. But the really neat thing that it did that I really liked is once I finished my profile, then it matched my profile up with someone from the Bible. And when I got done, I looked at who it matched me up with and said that my personality profile is a lot like King David. And I thought, sweet, you know? I mean, it could have been worse. It could have been Judas, right? You know? And so I'm thinking, King David, that's pretty good. I mean, this guy was creative, and he loved music, and he was a writer, and he was bold, and he stuck to it, and he was a leader, and he was a warrior, and the Bible said that he was a man after God's own heart. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's pretty cool. That's awesome. And so I went home, and I was so excited. I went home and told Anne, you're never going to believe. I took this test. It told me that I was a lot like King David. And she's like, oh, no. You know, because he's the Bathsheba dude, right? You know, that's no good. And so here's the thing about David. While David has all these incredible characteristics that are so positive, he also has this deep, dark underbelly. And lurking in that underbelly is this thing called envy. Envy. Now, God said about David's, David, my heart was to give you so much more, but you went out and grabbed it all yourself. And so as I did this profile and it wrapped up, what it said to me was this, that the sin that I have to be on guard for, the sin I have to watch out for in my life is the sin of envy. And I finished that test, and you know, a lot of you, if you take those tests, you go, nah, that's not me. You know, that's not me at all. It doesn't define. I don't have an issue with envy. Well, upon further review, all right, I have come to understand that if I leave envy unchecked in my life, it is something that could take me down. And it can take you down too. And here's why. Because envy comes from a heart that's discontent. A heart that some way, somehow is unsatisfied. And it's okay to have a good drive. It's okay to have healthy ambitions. But when those ambitions cross over to selfish ambitions, that's when trouble lurks in. You see, we know when we cross that line. We know when envy rears its ugly head. You see, envy rears its ugly head when we have a friend who gets a great deal on something, but we have to pay full price, right? Envy rears its ugly head when somebody that you know gets invited to a party, but you do not. I mean, envy rears its ugly head when one of your friend's kids makes the all-star team, but yours does not. I mean, envy rears its ugly head when your sister brings a dish to a family gathering and everyone goes on and on about how great and smart, how wonderful this dish is, and no one even touches yours. I mean, that's envy. And envy can be tough in families, can it? I mean, I grew up in southern Indiana. I told you that before. I grew up in a place called Vandenberg County. But what made matters worse is all my family lived in Posey County, all right? And it sounds just like it is, all right? I mean, it is Posey County. It is nothing there but farms and good old farm people. And I always, you know, I was always dreaded going to Thanksgiving because we go to my uncles and cousins for Thanksgiving and everyone would come over. And, you know, Thanksgiving was the end of November. And back up in those parts, once you hit October and November, I mean, the world changed because deer season kicked in, all right? I mean, people took off of work. I mean, kids would come to school late in their camos because deer season was in. And so when I went to the family gathering, here's what it was. Everyone was carrying around their pictures of the deer they already bagged that year. And they're, look at my 12-pointer, you know, look at my 10-pointer. Isn't that a beautiful buck? And I'm walking around going, I don't have any points, you know, I'm sorry, you know. And it wasn't like I was against hunting or didn't, I just didn't have time. I'm like, look at my report card, you know, that's all I've got. And, and it was always intimidating to go because even like my younger cousins, even the girls of my younger cousins had deers that they bagged. And I'm like, man, I just felt intimidated and envious about it. And so I'll never forget, I was a senior, I was out with some of my friends, and we were driving around at night, and from out of nowhere, bam, we got hit by a deer, all right? And my friend was driving, he had a Toyota Corolla hatchback. And I'll never forget, once we got hit, I mean, we got out, I mean, the car in the front was absolutely totaled, because the deer up there are like horses, all right? And we got out, and we were, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah. And so I went over, I'm like, whoa, that's a 14-pointer, you know? I'm like, does anybody have a camera? I've got to get a picture with this right here, you know? And I'm going to tell my cousins, I bagged a 14-pointer with a Corolla hatchback, you know? They're going to go to the store looking for that type of gun, a Corolla hatchback. Do we have a Corolla hatchback here, you know? And so sometimes envy is just that way. But let me give you a definition of envy we're going to work with. It's just this. Envy is resenting God's goodness in other people's life while ignoring his goodness in mine. Let me read that again. Envy is resenting God's goodness in other people's lives while ignoring his goodness in mine. And what envy tends to do is it tends to try to level the playing field by tearing other people down. I mean, you know this. I mean, you've been in these conversations before. You've been with a friend and you're talking and maybe you're talking about somebody and they say something really nice about someone maybe you've been a little envious about. And you go, oh yeah, her hair looked great, but can you believe her makeup? You know, Or maybe you question their intentions. And maybe you're sitting around talking with some friends about a business guy and you're going, wow, yeah, I had a really good year, had a really profitable year, made a lot of money. But in this economy, the only way that could happen is if they really cooked the books. Or maybe you try to one-up people. You know, someone went to Hawaii, it was their honeymoon, and they come back and go, wow, have you ever been to Hawaii? I mean, Hawaii has got to be the most beautiful place on the planet. Oh, it's nice, but have you ever been to Barbados? I mean, that's the real pretty place. Or maybe you try this spiritual, you know, guilt trip, one-up thing. You know, someone goes to Hawaii, you come back, oh, you went to Hawaii? Oh, yeah. Well, I just went to Haiti. You know, we were there serving the poor and orphans. You know, envy makes you say things like that because what envy wants is for you to come out on top. Wants for you to look better than everybody else. And the truth of the matter is, that is never going to happen. And so this thing called envy comes from deep within inside of us. It comes from an unsatisfied heart. It comes from a discontent heart, and that heart tends to become bitter. And so this thing called envy is dangerous. And so I thought we'd just take a couple minutes, not a long time, but just look at a couple observations about envy. And here's my first observation about envy. It's simply this. Envy ruins our health. Envy ruins our health. I mean, you know that to be true. It is impossible to be an envious person and a healthy person. You can't, because envy just does a number on our insides. I mean, your peace is gone, and then your contentment is gone. Then your gratitude is gone, and then your joy is gone. And then when your joy is gone, your strength is gone. And what replaces your strength is anxiety and fear and worry. And it begins to rob you of your sleep, and your nerves get on edge, and your body begins to break down. You have headaches and backaches and stomach aches and hypertension. I mean, listen to what the writer of Proverbs says in chapter 14, verse 30. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. And so that's the first observation. Envy ruins our health. Here's the second one. It's simply this. Envy breeds unhealthy competition. Envy breeds unhealthy competition. It just throws the balance of life completely out of whack. I mean, we will run at an insane pace to either keep up with or get ahead of the Joneses. And then what happens is this unhealthy competitive nature tends to kick in. Well, your kid's in two soccer leagues? Well, I'm signing my kid up for three. I mean, you got a 50-inch flat screen TV? I am getting a 60-inch flat screen TV. You're putting up 10,000 Christmas lights? I'm putting up 1,000,000 Christmas lights. I mean, David's son Solomon, he knew all about this competitive nature thing. And listen to what he said about that in his journal, Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Then I observed that most people are motivated to success by their envy of their neighbors. But this too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. I mean, that's good. Well, here's the third observation about envy. Envy ravages relationships. Envy ravages relationships. You know why? Because when you have envy in your heart, it is not free to either give or receive love. You begin to see people around you as a threat. You do not trust positive intentions. You become self-centered. What about me? What about me? What about me becomes the only thing that you think. Friends, tons of relationships and friendships and families and businesses and teams and churches have been absolutely destroyed by envy. I mean, listen to what James says when he puts it this way in verse 4. Where do you think all these appalling wars and quarrels come from? Do you think they just happen? Think again. I mean, they come about because you want your own way and fight for it deep inside yourselves. You lust for what you don't have and are willing to kill to get it. You want what isn't yours and will risk violence to get your hands on it. The writer of Proverbs says this in chapter 27, anger is cruel and wrath is like a flood, but who can survive the destructiveness of jealousy? James 3 says it this way, for where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and evil practice. So this thing called envy is one ugly green-eyed monster, and it comes from deep within us, from this place of unsatisfied heart, of a discontent heart that becomes bitter. Well, listen to this great quote from Ann Voskamp. She said this in her book, A Thousand Gifts. Satan's sin becomes the first sin of all humanity, the sin of ingratitude. Adam and Eve are simply painfully ungrateful for what God gave. I mean, isn't that the catalyst of all my sins? Our fall was, has always been, and will always be that we aren't satisfied in God and what he gives. We hunger for something more, something other, so we eat, and in an instant, we are blind. No longer do we see God as one we can trust. No longer do we perceive him as holy good. No longer do we observe all of the remaining paradise. We are hungry. We eat. We are filled with emptiness. I mean, what if you and I could learn to be grateful? I mean, what if we could stop hungering for more and we can just taste and see that God is good? You see, there is something out there so much better than envy. There is something out there that can just sweep all that crud out of our lives. There is something out there that can give us the rebellious joy that we all want. And that something is gratitude. It's gratitude. You can't have a heart that's full of envy and a heart that's full of gratitude at the same time. These two things cannot coexist. And so as we spend a couple minutes looking at a couple observations about envy, let's look at a couple observations about gratitude and how having a grateful heart can breathe contentment into our life. Well, here's the first observation I'm going to share. It's simply this. Gratitude is aware. Gratitude is aware. It just notices things. It notices little things and big things. And it doesn't so much notice what other people have. It notices what you are blessed to have. I mean, the reoccurring theme all throughout this incredible four-chapter book over and over and over is gratitude. I mean, Paul says over and over again, I am thankful for, I am grateful for, I rejoice because all that God has done. I mean, on and on and on he goes. And not just in this letter, but in every single letter that Paul writes, that is the theme throughout it. And so as we jump into chapter 4, look what it says in verse 4. He says, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. He's saying you need to live with a joyful lifestyle. Choose joy. Choose to be the kind of person that is living with a life that is aware of all that God has done. Look around, notice things, mark it down. Choose to live as the most blessed person on the planet. And in case you forgot, let me say it again, rejoice. I mean, that's what he's saying. And someone once said this, great quote, "It's not joy that makes us ungrateful, it's gratitude that makes us joyful." You see, joy is a byproduct of gratitude. And someone who lives a grateful life, a grateful heart, they live in the awareness of all that God is doing around them and has done around them. And it's not just the big things they see, it's the little intricate things that they notice. It's all the colors that make up a sunrise or a sunset. It is the cool breeze on their face. It is the smell of a new baby. It is the tone of a text message from their friend. I mean, it's watching a couple walk down the street holding hands and noticing their love. It's the sound of crunching leaves under their feet. They notice those things and they live with gratitude because they're aware of all that God is doing around them. Listen to this quote here from Frederick Buechner. It says this, "Listen to your life. See it for the fathomless mystery that it is. In the boredom and pain, it is no less than in the excitement and gladness. Touch, taste, smell your way to the holy and hidden heart of it. Because in the final analysis, all moments are key moments, and life itself is grace." I mean, I am learning in my life that you simply cannot be grateful for only the things that you feel entitled to have. I mean, that word entitlement's a scary word, but it's a word that we know well. And it's an attitude that we sometimes can slip in, that, hey, I deserve this. That everything I have because I deserve it. Everything I have was owed to me, but it's not. It is all a gift from God. I mean, my job is not owed to me. I mean, my economic security is not owed to me. My health is not owed to me. My house is not owed to me. My spouse is not owed to me. My kids is not owed to me. The gas in my truck, the food on my table, the air I breathe is not owed to me. It is simply a blessing from a loving God. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but I find myself getting in a rut in my prayer life. Or I start going to God constantly and just asking and asking for things. And it's not that we shouldn't ask. Don't hear me wrong on that. But you know what? Sometimes we go to God, we should tell him thanks. Thanks for all that he has done. Thanks for all that he has given. Notice, be aware of what he's doing. And sometimes I just have to sit down and make myself write down a list of things that I'm thankful for. So as I was getting ready for this week, I did that this week, and here's my list. I'm thankful for the beauty of the rising sun. I'm thankful for the song the birds are singing. I'm thankful for the two squirrels chasing each other on the fence. I'm thankful for the sound of running water. I'm thankful for my incredible wife, her fervent prayers, her passion to serve, her tolerance for my quirks, for earplugs so she can deal with my snoring. I'm thankful for my boys, the joy they bring me. I'm thankful that they'll be in heaven with me. I'm thankful for the way they show their love to each other by picking on each other. I'm thankful for the smiles on their face, their mischievous ways, the sound of Eli's guitar filling the house. I'm thankful for my dog who lays at my feet, who greets me every time I walk in the door like I'm his hero. I'm thankful for my friends at Rosie's and that they named a meal after me, the El Gringo Special. It's the best Mexican hamburger in town. I'm thankful for the Hot Now sign at Krispy Kreme. And I'm very thankful for bacon, extra crispy. I'm thankful for my truck. And I'm thankful for the guy who fixes it often. I'm thankful for music and the way it makes me sing and dance, even though both are appalling. I'm thankful for friends, good friends, who I can be myself around, who laugh and cry with me, who make fun of me, who don't expect me to be the pastor, just Jason. I'm thankful for the sun, the way it feels on my skin, the joy it brings me on a cloudy day. I'm thankful for this church, this amazing people, the great staff, the vision. I'm thankful they let me be me. I'm thankful for air conditioning. I'm thankful for my country, and for better or worse, it's still by far the greatest country on earth. I'm thankful for my grandparents, the legacy they left in me, the love they showed me, the prayers that they prayed for me endlessly. I'm thankful for my mom, who did her best raising two kids as a single mom. I'm thankful for her countless unknown and untold sacrifices. I'm thankful for my dad who took a chance to reconnect with me. I'm thankful for a stepdad who was willing to take on the baggage of two kids and not just take care of us, but adopt us. I'm thankful for the blood of Jesus that washed me as white as snow. I'm thankful for an empty tomb that gives me hope. I'm thankful for the partnership I have with God in the gospel. I'm thankful that I'm God's masterpiece, that I have been adopted by him and given an unimaginable inheritance in heaven. I'm thankful. You know, sometimes we just need to take a few moments and jot down what we are thankful for. And if you haven't done that recently, I encourage you to maybe later today or sometime this week, just go and just write down what you're thankful for. Because it's amazing how when you have a heart that is thankful and you're thanking God for things, how it just pushes away that attitude of entitlement. And it gives you contentment in your life. Let me give you the second observation here then about this word gratitude. And simply this, gratitude in its purest sense has to be God-centered. You see, the book of James says that every good gift comes from God and it does not change like the shifting shadows. He is faithful. He is consistent. He is our source of gratitude. I mean, I love this quote from G.K. Chesterton. It simply says this, the worst moment for an atheist is when they're grateful and they have no one to thank. Isn't that good? Because at the heart of gratitude is anchored that the trust that there is someone to thank. And again, through all of Paul's letters, through everything he wrote, there's this whole spirit of gratitude and thankfulness. It just dominates all of his writings. I mean, he is so thankful for all that God is and all that God has done. And look what he says as we continue through chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. He says, do not worry about anything. Instead, pray. Pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank him for all he's done. Then you will experience God's peace, which exceeds anything we can understand. His peace will guard your hearts and minds as you live in Christ Jesus. He's saying you want to replace your worry and your fear and your anxiety and your stress with peace. Put that at the center of your life. Live with gratitude. Thank him for what he has done in your life. And when you do that, you remember that God is strong, that God is faithful, that God is able, that his love runs deep for you, and he constantly, constantly is pursuing you. And then what you can do with all that stuff, that fear and anxiety and worry, you can transfer all that to him, and then what he gives you in return is this peace that surpasses all understanding. And so live with grateful hearts. Live and understand that everything comes from God. And here's one last thing, or another thing let me share with you. Gratitude, it resists comparisons. Gratitude resists comparisons. You see, genuine gratitude enables you to be content with who you are and what you've been given. And you know, the comparison game is a very dangerous game to play. Because one of two things is always going to happen when you play the comparison game. You're either going to find someone who is better than you, and what happens? Envy kicks in. Or you're going to find someone who is not as good as you, according to you, and then all of a sudden, arrogance and pride is going to kick in. And so here's the deal about the whole myth of keeping up with Joneses. It is a myth. There's always going to be a set of Joneses who have more, and always Joneses who have less. And so stay away from the comparison game. Don't compare yourself. Don't compare your appearance. Don't compare your job. Don't compare your house. Don't compare your spouse. Don't compare your car. Don't compare your kids. Don't compare your parents. It is a dangerous thing to do. In fact, Paul warns the church in Galatians about this. Here's what he says. Make a careful exploration of who you are and the work that you have been given, and then sink yourself into that. Don't be impressed with yourself. Don't compare yourself with others. Each of you must take responsibility for doing the creative best you can with your own life. And did you catch that? Be grateful for who God made you to be. I tell you, this is a tough one, isn't it? Because it's easy for us to look around and compare ourselves to other people. And I'll be honest with you, when I first took this job, man, that was something that was really tough. When I've said this before, and I stepped into this role and I followed Dennis, and he's a great communicator and leader, and people would say, well, those are really big shoes to fill. And so what I tried to do is I tried to fill those shoes. I tried to be someone I wasn't. And then makes matters worse as a communicator and someone who's always looking for feedback. People come up and say, man, have you heard that sermon by Andy Stanley? Woo, that was a good one. Or did you hear what Stephen Furtick? Man, that was a really, really good one. And if I'm not careful, I let envy and comparison slip into my life and I start trying to be someone I'm not. And so what I had to do is really fight to hold on to the fact that I am content just being me. I am happy being Jason because God made me for a purpose. He made me for something. He didn't call me to be somebody else. He called me to be me. And so the truth of the matter for all of our lives, he called you to be you. And he is going to hold you and me accountable for our opportunities, for everything that happens in our lives, for the possibilities and the talents and the chances to affect the kingdom. He is going to hold us accountable for that, nothing more, nothing less. And I think it'd be really good for all of us to write this verse on the mirrors in your bathroom. We're going to put this on the screen here, and I want us to read this out loud. And here's the verse, and let's read this out loud together because I think every one of us need to hear this every morning. So read this out loud with me. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. And I think you need to try that tomorrow, all right? I think tomorrow morning when you wake up, you need to go in the mirror, you need to look in the mirror, you need to go, God, thank you for making me wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. You know, how well I know it. I mean, just remind yourself that you are God's workmanship, that you are marvelous and he created you for a purpose. And parents, let me just say this too. Let's make sure we teach this principle to our kids. I mean, too often we go to our kids and we say to our kids, I wish you were more like so-and-so. Why can't you act like so-and-so? You know what we need to say to our kids? You know what? No matter if you make straight A's or straight C's, whether you start or you ride the bench, no matter your first chair or last chair, if you are being the wonderfully complex best that you can be, then I am proud of you. Resist the urge to compare. And let me give you one last point here about gratitude, and simply this. Gratitude is all-inclusive. Gratitude is all-inclusive. You know, one of the tough parts about working at a church is not everything that happens is all good. You know, sometimes we get those calls where emergencies or critical situations pop up, and those can be really, really hard, especially when you see people and you meet people going through some tough moments in their life. I mean, it is overwhelming to deal with. And a while back, we had a lady in the church who had cancer. And man, she'd tell you, every time I went to see her, every time I went to talk to her, I mean, it was just overwhelming because, you know, I'd go expecting to encourage her, to uplift her. But I came out every single time encouraged and uplifted by her. Because what she saw is her life was an absolute blessing from God. And she even would say, cancer has been a blessing as well. Because cancer gave me the opportunity to do things and say things to people that I never would have had a chance to do. And she led so many people to Christ. And I'll never forget, as she was kind of wrapping up her last lap of her life. I mean, every single time you would meet her, it wasn't down, it wasn't woe is me. It was looking at life as a blessing, looking at everything she's experienced as a true blessing from God. Because here's the truth that she knew, that if gratitude is gratitude, that means you are thankful for both the good and the bad. Listen to what Henry Nouwen wrote. Henry Nouwen said these words, "To be grateful for the good things that happen in our lives is easy, but to be grateful for all of our lives, the good as well as the bad, the moments of joy as well as the moments of sorrow, the successes as well as the failures, the rewards as well as the rejections that require hard spiritual work. Still, we are only grateful people when we can say thank you to all that has brought us to the present moment. As long as we keep dividing our lives between events and people we would like to forget, we cannot claim the fullness of our beings as a gift from God to be grateful for. Let's not be afraid to look at everything that has brought us to where we are now and trust that we will soon see it in the guiding hand of a loving God." That's incredible. Listen to what Paul said as he said similar things. Here's what he said in verse number 11. "Not that I was ever in need, for I have learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I've learned the secrets of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little, for I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength." Now, you know, I've read that verse tons and tons of times. But you know, I caught something this week that I've never seen before. Two times, Paul says, "I have learned." I mean, what do you think that means? I mean, here's what I think. Paul said, "I didn't get it the first time. I didn't get it the second time. I didn't get it the third time. But I had to practice practice, practice, practice. I had to do it over and over and over and over again to figure out and understand that this is the key to life. This gratitude, the heart of gratitude, a heart that is fulfilled, a heart that is at peace, is what it's all about. And I don't know about you, but I want that key to life. I want that peace in life. I want that rebellious joy in my life. I want a heart that is content. I want a heart that is satisfied even in the midst of death and divorce and miscarriages and foreclosures. I mean, I want to learn to live that kind of life because that's the kind of world that we live in. And so my encouragement to you, my encouragement to myself, is for us to practice, 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 practice. To do it over and over and over again so that we can find the key to rebellious joy. And Paul says that key is contentment. You know, this week I had an appointment with a lady who came in, and she had a pretty tough last 30 days. And she came in and she told me a story. She's told me what happened 30 days ago. She walked into her office and it was a normal day, a place that she'd worked almost two decades. And she came in later in the day and there was a meeting. And so she walked into the meeting, looked around the room, and all of a sudden she noticed HR was there. And that's usually not a good sign. And so she sat there and waited for them to begin talking. And of course, they then delivered the news that everyone hates to hear. We are downsizing. We're cutting positions and you are one of them. And she said in that moment, she began to tear up, but then she stopped herself. She says, no, I am not going to tear up because I have been in situations where I've had plenty and I've been in situations where I had absolutely nothing, and God has been there and faithful every step of the way. And she said, what I began to do is in that moment where I felt like I was just absolutely punched in the gut, I began to find peace and contentment. And I knew that no matter what happened here, that God was faithful, that he was in control, and that there was something better waiting for me around the corner. I mean, I walked out of that meeting going, man, you can preach this weekend. I don't need to, you know? I mean, you get it. You understand it. You see what rebellious joy is all about. It is having that unbelievable contentment in our hearts.